Chapter 9. Day 4 in Jail. I had gone in and found we were locked out of our labs. The key card access didn't work, and it appeared when I looked in that Judy's drawers had been gone through in her desk. And it was weird because her office door was open. She always locks the doors, and this door wasn't even shut. It was cracked open. Her stuff had been gone through, so I let her know. Max Post, on what he observed at the WPI on the day after Mikovits was terminated. Monday, November 21st, 2011. A jarring 5:45 a.m. breakfast announcement roused Mikovits from her unyielding jail cell bed, and she thought this was the day she would finally see her lawyer and make bail. She stretched her limbs, marveling how even a mattress could be made to feel punitive. She was comforted by the belief that whatever pressure was meant to be exerted on her, the facts would now begin to sort themselves out. It had been the perfect moment to arrest her, a Friday afternoon at the end of a waning work week, and who knew if anybody had expected this mysterious bail hold to keep her in jail over the weekend. Mikovits rationally concluded that by late Friday afternoon, the situation had so baffled and hampered the authorities that they decided to address her case after Monday morning coffee. Even though Mikovits did not realize it then, she had not been abandoned over the weekend by either her family or her professional colleagues. 2 days previously, David had told her that Frank Rossetti and Ian Lipkin of Columbia were trying to reason with Harvey on Judy's behalf, an account later verified by Ian Lipkin in the pages of the journal Nature. Before she was incarcerated, I tried to negotiate some sort of agreement between her and the Institute so that this would not happen. One of the problems was that she really did need access to her laboratory notebooks so that she could answer questions from scientists and patients, and she was not given an option to do that. Frank Rossetti would also provide an account of what happened in the wake of Mikovits's arrest in a declaration from May 17, 2012. Rossetti explained, "After Dr. Judy Mikovits was arrested and incarcerated in the Ventura County Jail, I spoke with several members of the scientific community, including Ian Lipkin, M.D., Mike Bush, Mary Carrington, Mike Dean, Frank Maldarelli, Steve Bartlemez, and others. We were all in a state of shock and outrage that a scientist could be arrested for possessing data notebooks. As demonstrated below, WPI's data notebooks do not contain any trade secrets or proprietary information. Moreover, research scientists are always provided with copies of their federally funded research notes. In the seemingly murky waters of intellectual property, both sides superficially seem to have merit. From the WPI's perspective, shouldn't an institution own the results of research that it sponsors to exploit for financial gain? However, the WPI is a non-profit, taxpayer-supported institution. Shouldn't everything from such a facility belong to the taxpayers and donors who support its research? Conversely, doesn't an academic researcher possess a personal responsibility to publish articles based on that work in scientific journals and add not only to the store of human knowledge, but also to his or her own academic reputation and that of her students? To Mikovits, the truth was straightforward from the perspective of science. She was the principal investigator on 3 government grants, RO1, Lipkin, and DOD. These awards came with duties and obligations, with her paramount responsibility being the protection of public monies as well as upholding the integrity of the scientific work that such funds had purchased. She believed there was nothing foggy about it, as her moral compass pointed right outside of the institution's doors toward the greater public need. But even if each side felt strongly about their position, There were others for whom the entire affair was astounding. Lipkin later recalled, "To try to adjudicate some sort of agreement so she doesn't go to jail, it's a little beyond the pale. I hope I never do anything like this again." But Mikovits didn't have the luxury of walking away from the situation. Her professional reputation was on the line. She believed the real reason for her current legal difficulties was because, one, of what she had said in Ottawa in August when the results of the blood working group had been revealed, and, two, she had prevented Lombardi from using the grant-funded cells and thus ensured that the WPI could not claim salary support for him, as he had done no work in the research program that year. For others, it may have been a question of interpretation, but Mikovits felt allowing a researcher to do a day of work on a grant, then claiming part of his salary for a much greater time period, was unethical. Mikovits believed the information, contained in her notebooks and personal email record, was evidence to her claims, and would likely convince the NIH to allow her to take the grants to another institution that could support them. She did not fear anything in the notebooks. That's why she was trying to protect them. Let the world read them. She had nothing to hide. At around 4 o'clock on a dragging afternoon, jail personnel received a call that Mikovits had a pastoral visit. Free time didn't come until much later, and Marie had slept most of the day. She was prepared and led to the visiting area. Waiting for her in that space, the one without a Hollywood plastic window but with a rather bland institutional table and chairs, was no pastor but her fill-in attorney, Tom Adams, who was covering while Dennis Neal Jones was recovering from a knee replacement. "Hi, Tom," said Judy lightly, not sure of the proper formalities. He was friendly enough in return. "Hi, Judy." She thought of all the retrospective things she could take him to task on now, such as, "See, wasn't I correct that people were following me before I was arrested?" And, "Do you remember how I called you up on Friday morning and you assured me that there was no warrant out for my arrest?" How could somebody be arrested when there was no warrant out? She wished she had been irrationally paranoid instead of right. Tom leaned forward soberly. "Judy, Max Post called your husband and told him you had the notebooks, and you knew you had the notebooks." "I don't have the notebooks. I never saw the contents of the bag of materials Max secured when he found my office open and ransacked the morning after I was fired." Mikovits saw a look of disbelief sweep over Tom's face as he firmed up. "Judy, you need to tell your lawyers the truth." Maybe it was the lack of sleep or the petty indignities of being in jail, but Mikovits felt spitting mad. "Tom, I did tell you the truth. You had selective hearing before my arrest. You didn't even ask me what happened on those crucial days of October 16th and 17th. You asked what happened within 72 hours of when I'd been fired and if I had ever been back to the WPI. Then, without any warning, I'm in jail. The affidavit you tried to file, which the court mysteriously rejected, is inaccurate to boot because you didn't listen. To top it off, I am blindsided and dragged off to a cell when you claim there wasn't even a warrant out for my arrest. How exactly could this happen?" "Well, just tell me what's going on." "You tell me what's going on," she snapped. Tom put his elbows on the table as if settling in to let the story uncoil. "Okay. Max called David and said, 'The jig is up.'" Mikovits almost laughed at the hard-boiled, archaic expression. "The jig is up?" Only Harvey Whittemore talked like that. It had to be a borrowed phrase. Max Post and Harvey Whittemore had a complicated relationship. As Max recounted in a 2014 interview, I could never figure him out. Sort of a sly guy. I kind of felt like he was a friend, a nice guy, but I think he manipulates things. Yeah, I think manipulator is a good word. Later, Max would tell Mikovits that Harvey Whittemore was listening on the phone line when he had phoned David. After Mikovits had been fired and Max had kept her informed of eerie happenings at the WPI, like the shutting down of the lab for a week and the brusque removal of everything from the labs and from her office, Max grew fearful that his taking of the notebooks would be discovered. These fears would lead Max to make some decisions he would later regret, especially the trust he would give to Harvey Whittemore. As Post recalled in that same 2014 interview, it was after I was meeting with Harvey's lawyers and they were grilling me pretty good, and they dropped me back at home, and I was sitting there, worked up, and so at the time I felt like Harvey was looking out for my best interests, this whole thing. Because he was putting in my mind that Judy was out to set me up with this whole taking the notebooks so it looks like I'm the fall guy. Tom continued the story, saying that David didn't know what Max was saying. But Max had pressed on, saying he knew that Judy had the notebooks. David told him they'd unpacked all the boxes from Judy's Reno condominium after she was terminated, and there was nothing there. Mikovits sat back. What she'd just heard about Max was deeply disquieting because she had not taken the notebooks, Max had, and Mikovits did not know where they were. So why was Max being evasive? It was hard to fathom a motive, even though his fear was palpable. She thought maybe Max was being truthful, yet playing an unintentional shell game with the notebooks. Or maybe Max had taken the notebooks to copy them, in order to protect her when he left in the early morning hours of October 17th to meet a friend. Or maybe Max had packed them so she would not know their exact location, just in case she was stopped and questioned by someone connected to Harvey Whittemore. So, do you have the notebooks, or don't you? Tom probed. Well, I don't know, Dr. Mikovits replied. She would have to describe the night of October 16th and 17th, after her plane landed in Reno at 1 o'clock in the morning, up until Max left at 8 a.m. for his job at the WPI. She took a deep breath and plunged into her story. She wanted to impress upon Tom Adams the absolute importance of the notebook in scientific research. From the days of Leonardo da Vinci, the notebook of a scientist provided an incorruptible record of one's research, thoughts, questions, and conclusions at a specific point in time. Da Vinci's own notebooks display his forward-thinking contribution to history. They show graceful sketches of a manned glider based on the wings of birds, blueprints for the first tank, even the principles that would enable helicopters to fly. Protocol might have changed over the centuries, but the basic pattern remained consistent. First and foremost, a daily record of lab work was kept. Any attempt to alter the contents, such as ripping out the page for a less than successful day, was obvious. The system is low-tech, but incredibly effective. The notebook had to remain intact. The notebooks of Mikovits held the key to resolving the controversy raging around XMRV, the validity of the diagnostic test by VIPDX, and so much more. Mikovits didn't care if the notebooks proved or debunked her theory. They simply needed to be maintained and protected so future researchers could determine whether she had been right or wrong. That was how science moved forward atop a solid cogwheel of proof and disproof, made up of simply scribed data in a basic notebook. Beyond the imperative of science to present the unvarnished truth, Mikovits had a deeper motivation. The research contained in those notebooks had been bought and paid for by U.S. taxpayers who wanted answers, and they held names linking to coded identifications of more than 800 study participants whom she had vowed to protect with scientific confidentiality. From a populist and a scientific point of view, they did not belong to a singular institution or person. She had to impress upon Tom the other critical piece, that she believed the Whittemores were in serious financial trouble, which she felt was enough to fog anyone's mind and generate impulsive behavior. This claim would be echoed in the lawsuit later brought by the former partners of the Whittemores, the Sino family of Concord, California, which would paint a similar picture of desperation. With that in mind, Mikovits began to recount the events for Tom Adams. Annette Whittemore fired Mikovits over the phone at around 4:30 p.m. on Thursday, September 29, 2011. It was an uneventful day prior to the Lombardi brouhaha. Mikovits had left the Whittemore-Peterson Institute about a half hour earlier after going to the lab to tell her research associate, Shanti Rawat, that she would be taking the next day to move David's possessions out of the condo they had been renting the past 10 months from the Whittemores, as her Riverwalk condo was being repaired from mold. Mikovits would then be moving her things back to the Riverwalk, as her lease was up September 30th. David would be moving back home to Oxnard, and Judy would commute to Reno beginning in October of 2011. It had all been prearranged when Judy gave the Whittemores notice of her intentions by email in August of 2011. Mikovits told Rawat she was placing the office keys in the lab drawer as usual, and that she would fly back on Monday morning, mentioning that the Whittemores were aware of her plans, and that Max was helping her move. Mikovits added a cordial, "Have a nice weekend." The call from Lombardi came in on her cell phone as she was walking down the street. Lombardi said, gruffly, "Tell me where the cells are. They were sent to me." Mikovits snapped, "Didn't I tell you that you were no longer part of the research program? I will be back on Monday and we can discuss it then." She hung up quickly. Annette Whittemore swooped in immediately, calling Mikovits's cell phone about a minute later and no longer playing nice. Annette screamed, "You give him those cells. They were shipped to him." "I told you Lombardi is no longer in the research program. I am the principal investigator, PI, and responsible for all resources on all projects in the program. Those cells were purchased off the R01 grant without my knowledge or permission. That is illegal. I told you, given his failure to perform in the BWG, Lombardi was no longer in my program." Annette seemed frantic. "I have had enough of your insolence. So is it rude to stop fraud and misappropriation of federal funds? I am the research director and I said no." "You are no longer the research director," Annette proclaimed. "You are fired." At first, Mikovits just stared at the phone. As she stood on the street, Max arrived to take her to pick up the rental car from the airport. Max saw her face and immediately asked what was wrong. "Annette had a hissy fit and fired me, but she'll get over it." There had been an incident the past spring where Mikovits had threatened to quit because of what she viewed as a conflict of interest involving Lombardi and VIPDX, which she thought had been resolved. That's one thing which was so difficult to later convey to people. For the vast majority of her time working in Nevada, Judy had trusted the Whittemores. They had worked through their problems, as do people who deeply respected each other. "Well, what do you want to do?" asked Max. "We have a job to do. I have to move David's stuff out of Harvey's apartment," she replied. Little did she know that this time there would be no reconciliation. The first inkling that things were not going to bounce back came at 5 a.m. the next morning when Max called. "I'm really concerned because I can't get into the WPI building. My key card access isn't working, he said. Max wanted to run a gel for an experiment, and as most students, he usually worked odd hours. He was upset by the events of the previous evening and thus arrived at the WPI around 5 in the morning. He had put the gel in the refrigerator the day before and wanted to get it started, since it usually took several hours to run the experiment. Mikovits was an early riser as well, but the experience of being fired had made her sleep fitful and unreliable. All she wanted to do was get in the packed SUV and drive home to Southern California and to David. She left with an SUV containing David's clothes around 3:30 in the morning and was just outside of Sacramento in Northern California when Max's call came. He could not find a way into the building. She told him it probably wasn't anything to worry about, as there had been prior break-ins and a lack of security since the new academic building had opened, and perhaps the key code access had been changed for that reason. She suggested he come back at 7 a.m. when the doors to the building were supposed to automatically open. When Max returned at 7, he was able to get through the initial doors, but then his key card did not allow him access to his own lab containing the keys to his own office. While there, he saw that Mikovits's office was unlocked, her drawers were open, and it looked like somebody had rifled through them, plus her flash drives were on her desk. He called her in a panic. Now I am really scared. It is not like you to leave your office unlocked. Describe what is going on, she asked him in a calm voice. Your desk drawers are open, he said. Is anything gone? Mikovits asked. I don't know what was in there. Mikovits conjured up a mental picture of her office. Which desk drawers? The ones in the main desk. Is the file behind the main desk open? The one where the textbooks are? No, it's locked, said Max. I will take a picture of your desk with my phone and send it to you. Mikovits looked at the image Max had sent and allowed a sigh of relief. She didn't know what was going on, but the notebooks had to be secured. The desk drawers were open and unlocked, but the contents appeared to be fairly undisturbed as each drawer was full to the top. The confrontation with Lombardi had been the final straw in what she suspected were a string of unethical, foolish, and possibly illegal acts at the WPI. She had wrestled with the issue of whether they were simply innocent mistakes or a pattern of something more sinister. What was it the police always asked in a murder investigation? With whom did the victim last have an argument? It was not the final judgment, but it was a good place to start. She'd had an argument with the Whittemores, whom she felt were disgruntled because of the events of the blood working group diagnostic tests and Lombardi's removal from her research program. She had been fired by Annette Whittemore for insolence and insubordination only 12 hours earlier, and now her office had been ransacked, a string of events that surpassed coincidence. Aside from what looked like evidence of the Whittemores' actions, Mikovits believed the notebooks contained evidence of Lombardi's mistakes and a cover-up of his failure to perform. There was a reason that of all the drawers and files in her two offices, only those two drawers had been opened, and Mikovits knew what it was. She believed there were a fair number of people at the WPI who would find the information in her notebooks to be, at the very least, embarrassing, if not downright incriminating. What should I do? Max asked anxiously. At the time of her termination, there had been a great deal of controversy over whether contamination could explain the XMRV results. The lab books would be an unvarnished record of what had happened. Max clearly understood their importance, as he later recalled. We'd always had these lab meetings with the concern of the lab being contaminated. And we pretty much did everything we could to figure out how our lab could be contaminated. In one of the notebooks, I think it was Katie's notebook, there was a lab meeting that Vinnie Lombardi was asking to pull out the plasmids in the bacterial cells and grow it up. And Judy said no to that. It was in the notebooks. Judy said, "No, don't do that. It could only get the virus everywhere." And I think Katie also put an email attachment into her notebook that said, "No, we're not going to do that because Judy told me not to do that." We were afraid that page or that notebook would just end up missing, and then, I don't know, there would be a lawsuit where everything would get blamed on us. Mikovits told him he needed to secure the notebooks. "Put them in the lab. Put them in your office. I don't care." "I can't get into the lab or my office," he replied, a little panicked. "Take them to my condo, then. Harvey has the key to your condo, remember?" "Take them to your mother's place, then, for Christ's sake. Just secure them. They have patient data and information. I don't really care what you do, but secure them until I can get back and see what's going on." "This is my work, too," said Max protectively. She knew Max well enough that she felt she could almost hear the wheels in his head turning, that he would be appalled at the idea of Lombardi taking credit for work he hadn't done. She asked him to do one more thing, to go down to her old office in the Applied Research Facility and make certain it was secure, and then call back. He called a half hour later and said it was locked and that he did not have the key. "That's okay," Mikovits reassured him. The data in her old office, the data from Peterson and her earlier work, were safe because the keys were on the ring she left in the lab with Shanti that day. Or were they? Dr. Mikovits knew she could entrust Max to protect the notebooks. She continued her trek to Southern California. As the recently fired director of research at the WPI, Mikovits now had a dilemma. She was scheduled to travel to the United Kingdom and Ireland from October 7th through 16th to give a series of talks in Tullamore, Newry, Belfast, and Sunderland. Should she still go? Once home in Oxnard with David, she emailed and called the groups in the United Kingdom and Ireland to inform them of recent events. They still wanted her to come and said they would minimize the issue of her recent firing. Mikovits thought that was a good idea, telling her hosts she was sure Annette would get over it, that she was simply mad about the diagnostic test, and that by the time Mikovits returned from abroad, the storm would in all likelihood have passed. She felt a special bond with the UK and Irish sufferers of the disease, and was grateful to turn her attention to something positive and also far from home. The previous October and May, she had traveled to the United Kingdom and Ireland for a series of talks. One in particular, her talk in Belfast on May 22, 2011, had touched her. The event was held in the largest meeting room at the Holiday Inn. Most of those in attendance were patients with ME/CFS and their loved ones. A table was set up at the front of the room with the members of the panel, including Dr. William Weir, an infectious disease consultant who chaired the meeting, and Member of Parliament Basil McRae. Joan McParland, who had recently founded an ME/CFS support group, opened the meeting. "I'm finished with potions, lotions, and quacks," she said in her introductory remarks. "It's time for some real science." Along the wall at the front of the room was a picture display of patients with ME/CFS, listing their names and how long they'd been ill. To Mikovits, it looked like the sort of memorial display one might have seen 25 years earlier during the height of the AIDS epidemic, or after the attacks of September 11, 2001. Many of the people in the pictures were not physically present, immobilized by the illness, but Mikovits knew they would be waiting for a detailed report of what had happened at the conference. As she looked out at the crowd of people, she thought with sadness of the price many would pay in the following days and weeks. The post-exertional malaise, or PEM, of many ME/CFS sufferers meant that any extra energy they expended, such as going to listen to a conference for several hours, would cost them dearly with punishing symptoms. More than a few of the people in the audience would probably spend the next few days or weeks in bed, trying to recover to their prior functioning just from a trivial outing. Many could not even consider attending. The physical payback would be too severe. Mikovits was moved by the story told by the mother of a 19-year-old son with ME/CFS and another family of a cute 12-year-old brown-haired boy standing nervously beside his mother, father, and brother. One mother told of how one of the doctors had blamed her son for his condition, claiming he had caused his own joints to swell, a physical impossibility. Another doctor blamed the mother because she had painted her son's bedroom a color he didn't like. Mikovits believed that future scientists would look back in horror at how these patients had been treated. At the end of her talk, they had presented her with a hurley, a wooden stick that looked like a large paddle, used in the Irish sport of hurling. President Barack Obama was given a similar hurley stick in 2011 by the Prime Minister of Ireland. At the time, Obama quipped that he would use it on members of Congress. When the hurley was presented to Mikovits, she had wondered aloud, "How am I going to get this past Homeland Security?" On the hurley stick, the members of the committee had engraved the Irish expression, "Chucky Arlaw," which means, "Our day will come." Mikovits loved these patients who could cling to a phrase of uplift in the midst of struggle. She was glad that even though the WPI had fired her, the English and Irish communities still waited with rapt attention for her to discuss her research. She would not let them down. If the Ireland trip was supposed to lift her spirits, the news from Reno, relayed by a harried Max, only deepened her concern. According to Post, after she was fired, the lab had been shut down for 7 solid days from September 29th to October 7th, in a hasty lockdown. Max had remained locked out of the lab, unable to work. The Whittemores claimed it was a vacation for the staff with pay. When Max was able to get back into the lab on October 8th, he found they had quite literally stripped the lab of everything in it. They had confiscated the reagents, the computers, and the notebooks of every worker out of the lab. The Whittemores took Max's notebooks and personal computer. Post said that when they returned his personal computer, it had been wiped clean. Given his close relationship to her, Post remained a subject of suspicion. As he later related, "I wasn't allowed to do any work. I believe I had my office for a good time. I caught up on 3 television shows, like 5 seasons, just watching in my office because I didn't have any work, but I was still required to show up every day. If I did any work, he, Lombardi, would supervise the work over my shoulder." Max also told Mikovits that while she was in Ireland, they had completely gutted her office. All of this was sounding very suspicious, and Mikovits was relieved Max had gone back to the lab in the early morning hours of September 30th and been able to secure the key notebooks and files from her desk drawers. Why were they seizing all the data and reagents from the research laboratory? She worried they were planning to manipulate the data in the computer. Mikovits's greatest fear was that the Whittemores were going to create their own narrative of the past 5 years, justifying her censure and demise. As part of this rewritten history, she also feared they were going to claim Lombardi had been working in the research lab, even though he had not, so they could charge the government for part of his salary. Mikovits was also clear in her belief that Lombardi had not done a single experiment in the research laboratory in all of fiscal year, FY, 2011. And all of that information was in the notebooks of both Mikovits and those collaborators who worked with her since she had moved into the new office in August of 2010. Mikovits strongly believed that Katie Hagen's notebook would show that on March 23, 2009, Lombardi had directed Hagen to pull out the patient's cells and culture them along with Silverman's VP62 XMRV expressing LNCAP in Mikovits's own lab, in direct violation of her orders, raising the possibility of contamination. While this took place after the most critical experiments, it introduced an element of uncertainty in the work, one which would take a great deal of effort to refute. Those two drawers also contained the sequences of viruses generated in Rossetti's lab. Data supporting evidence of retroviruses other than VP62, as she had shown Harvey in July of 2011. And if any of this had indeed happened, as Mikovits feared, it would all be documented in the notebooks. Mikovits flew into Reno on October 17, 2011, arriving at about 1 in the morning. Max picked her up in his Jeep. He had just turned 30 years old, and in the back of his Jeep was that orange and yellow celebratory birthday bag. He pointed to the bag and said, "I've got the notebooks." He told her he had dropped off and then later picked up the notebooks from his mother's house and that they were all secure. Mikovits nodded and they drove to the condo she owned, known as the Riverwalk condo. Once at Mikovits's condo, Max handed her a beer and she stood at the stand-up bar between the kitchen and living room. She took a sip and paused to look out the window at the lights of Reno, the self-proclaimed biggest little city in the world. How had it all come to this? "Okay, Max, here's my plan," she said, pointing to the yellow and orange striped cheerful birthday bag that now held the notebooks. "When you go to work in the morning, I'm going to go back to the Whittemore condo at the Palladio to get the last of my stuff. Then I will take the notebooks to the Kinko's around the corner and copy them. Then I'm going to pack the car and head out of here." Her mind was focused on getting duplicates of the data so that the record of their work would not be destroyed. Max said he had already started packing her things from the Whittemore-owned condo at the Palladio she had been living at for the last 15 months and pointed to some U-Haul boxes scattered about the living room. "I've got your things on that side of the room and mine on the other." She saw how he had tidily sectioned off their possessions in that big open room with the sliding glass doors that framed a sweeping view of the church and Sierra Nevadas. It was clear to Mikovits that Max felt threatened and perhaps even stalked by Harvey Whittemore, but what he did next completely shocked her. Max left the room, went down the hallway, and returned with what looked like a small packing box, not much bigger than a shoebox. He opened the box. Inside was a shining silver Glock 19 handgun. The Glock 19, a petite pistol, looking like it might fit inside a woman's handbag. It's made for concealment, a small weapon that an attacker wouldn't know the victim had until it was too late. Max encouraged her to take the gun for protection. Mikovits felt a sudden, overwhelming chill. The gun punctuated all of the words that had recently passed between them about the strange goings-on. As a scientist, a person who valued reason above brute force, it looked alien. She felt as if she had slipped into a dangerous netherworld. "Oh, Max, now you're being a bit paranoid here," she said, hoping to lighten the mood. When later asked why he even owned the Glock, Max replied, "Because I'm in Nevada, and it's fun to shoot guns." He told her not to go to the other condo at the Palladio or Kinko's. Max continued, "And Harvey's been stalking me the last 2 or 3 days." It was clear that Max was very concerned about their safety and felt that he had reason to worry. "Max, I am not going to use that gun," she protested. "Then don't leave this condo," he said heatedly. "Don't leave for anything. Pack up tomorrow, and I'll text you when the meeting starts, so you will know it's safe to leave and pick up the rental car." Lombardi was having his first official meeting the next day as research director. Max was convinced everybody would be in attendance, including Harvey. So he would check to make sure Lombardi's and Harvey and Annette's cars were in the parking lot and text her then. Once he texted her that it was safe, she could then leave the condo with a baseball cap pulled down over her head and walk to the Silver Legacy Casino. At the casino, she could hop a bus to the airport, pick up a rental car that was rented in the name of a friend, and drive back to the condo to pick up her boxes. It was a stressful but good plan. That night, before the next day's meeting at the WPI, Max pointed to a few of the boxes on her side of the room. "Those are David's books," he said. In addition to being an avid reader, David also had a collection of various Bibles, as he often wanted to compare a verse in one translation to the same verse in another. "They're too heavy for you to move. Wait until I come home, and I'll help you pack them in the car. I have a dolly, and it will be easy for me to move them. But please don't leave the condo for any reason." "Damn, I really wanted to go to the gym and work out," Mikovits said with frustration. "You will not be safe if you leave this condo," Max replied sternly. He offered the gun again, and again she shrugged it off. "Fine, I'll just stay here," she replied. Max didn't leave the gun with Mikovits, but his possession of it would prove to be a pivotal point in coming events. She later noticed the closed box on the desk and thought the gun was still in it, but she was wrong. She went over to one of the briefcases she had left on September 29th, as she had planned to return to work at the WPI the following Monday, and opened it. She found her key card, her parking pass for the WPI, and the Institute's laptop computer, and spent a moment gazing at them. She left the mall after she was fired because she thought Annette would get over her outburst about the cell line and the diagnostic test, and she would begin commuting to direct the grant-funded research. After 5 years, it was difficult to believe their relationship was at an end, as friends and colleagues, and, it seemed, groundbreakers. She had loved the Whittemores dearly, and like a suddenly scorned wife, she felt more grief than anger. She placed everything on the bar. "I don't think I'm going to need these anymore," she told Max. "Take them back after I'm out of the state." Mikovits went to her room and slipped under the covers wearing her jeans and a t-shirt. She tried to sleep, but tossed and turned. She recalled that she was supposed to have lunch with her former patient coordinator. The Whittemores had promised the woman a full-time job after the new building opened, and then hired their niece, Kellen Jones, instead, without telling anyone. The betrayal of her friend still hurt Mikovits. She texted her former patient coordinator. She hated to lie, but given what Max had said about the dangers of being seen, she did not want to risk the woman's safety. "I miss the plane in Santa Barbara," she wrote. "I will see you in the next couple of weeks when I pick up my things, but I won't be at the tap house because I'm not in Reno. I don't know when I'm going to get another flight." The woman texted back, "That's fine. I'll see you when I see you. Safe travels." Although she drifted off for a few hours, Mikovits woke at 5:30 and went to the living room to begin packing her clothes, towels and linens, glasses, and dishes. She noticed that Max had rescued her prized possession from the lab, the Hurley given to her the previous May on her trip to Ireland. As she held the smooth stick, she let her fingers linger over the inscription, "Chuck Yarla, our day will come." She glanced at the front door, at the birthday bag that had earlier contained the notebooks when Max had picked her up from the airport. It was now conspicuously empty. She thought, well, that's bizarre. But she could not wait to leave that gutted space. Like anyone who is packed and ready to hit the road, she figured she would sort out the contents of her boxes later, once she got the heck out of Dodge. "Where did you think the notebooks had gone?" Tom Adams asked. It startled Mikovits to hear him speak. She was talking for more than a half hour, trying to relay the chain of events. As she recounted the story, it had all been like a lucid waking dream. "Well, I'm no rocket scientist, but I thought Max packed them in my stuff to protect me from knowing where they were. I think he was concerned that Harvey Whittemore might stop me somewhere on the road and try to get them from me." She paused. It was better if I had no idea where the notebooks were. "But you thought they were there?" Tom asked. "Yes, I thought they were there, but I didn't know if they were." She explained to Tom Adams that after they had gone to their respective rooms to sleep at around 2:30 a.m., Max apparently left in the middle of the night to meet up with a friend and then went to work at 8 a.m. Around 11 o'clock, he texted her that everybody's cars were in the parking lot. Mikovits had gotten up at 5 a.m. to get ready for her trip, so she and Max were both operating on limited sleep. After Max texted, Mikovits put on her baseball cap, pulled it down, and furtively left the building for the quick walk to the Silver Legacy Casino, where she caught a bus to the airport. She picked up the rental car, drove into the underground parking, and proceeded to load up her boxes. She worked hurriedly, and soon the only boxes that remained were those containing David's weighty books. Max texted at about 1 o'clock and said the lab meeting was starting. The meeting should only last an hour, and he would probably get back to the condo by 3. When he hadn't arrived or even texted by 3:15, Mikovits was getting edgy, knowing she had at least an 8-hour drive ahead of her. She decided to open David's boxes herself and lighten the load so she could carry them. She placed half of them in a recyclable container. She then put the half-empty box on the U-Haul dolly and took them down to the rental car, returning with the recyclable container. Mikovits loaded the remaining books into the half-empty box and closed it up. She was starting to get antsy, thinking that she would not get home until midnight if she left any later. She texted Max and said she wanted to leave. "Hit the road, Jack," he replied. Mikovits jumped in the rental car and raced out of dry and dusty Reno, checking her rearview mirror every minute or two to see if she was being followed, smiling when she saw the highway climbing into the cool pine forests of the Sierra Nevada mountains, and breathing an enormous sigh of relief when the sign on the road announced she had entered California. Harvey Whittemore might be a Power Ranger in Nevada, a king of the legislature, with a close relationship to the leader of the U.S. Senate, but he didn't own California. This was her state, and it didn't owe a damn thing to Harvey Whittemore. Stagecoach drivers had once spurred their horses over similar routes west, glancing over their shoulders for lurking, omnipresent dangers. Mikovits revved her rented horsepower toward home. She thought about Max's text. "Hit the Road, Jack" was, of course, a song by the legendary Ray Charles. She found herself humming a few of the bars as she made her way south. Arriving around midnight, Judy went straight to bed, sleeping weightily until 8 o'clock the next morning. David put on a pot of coffee and they started to unload the car. The rental car was due at the Oxnard, California airport by noon, so David drove it back. At their beach house, Mikovits unloaded all of the boxes with the exception of 2 boxes of towels and sheets that were supposed to go to their other home, a condo near San Diego. When David returned, he carried the boxes upstairs and put them in the linen closet for the next time they went to San Diego. At the time, as far as she knew, there were no notebooks in any of the boxes. "You really don't expect me to believe that, do you?" Tom interjected skeptically. "I wish my attorney trusted my honesty, but that's the truth. Did I have plans to make sure the notebooks were protected? Yes, I did. Did I think they were in the stuff Max packed? Yes, I did. But when I unpacked the boxes, they were not there. Do you think if I knew where they were when I flew to Washington, D.C. on November 15th for my mom's 75th birthday, I would not have taken them with me for protection given the events of the past week? I wanted to keep copies of the data, the patient information, and the evidence of what the Whittemores and Lombardi had done safe with me. Yet at the end of the day, I didn't know where they were, so I didn't ask. We did the best we could to protect the study participants and the taxpayer-funded research." "Okay," said Tom, standing and preparing to leave. "So that's it? What's the plan for getting me out of here? When am I going to get bail?" "I don't know," said Tom. "I'm a civil attorney. You'll have to call your criminal attorney." And with that, Tom Adams turned and walked out of the jail. What Mikovits didn't know while she was in jail, what her attorney didn't know, and might possibly have made him reconsider what he thought he knew, was what had happened to Max since she left Nevada. While Max had played a pivotal role in securing the notebooks, he would also play an equally important role in her false arrest and imprisonment. In the months and years to come, she would have her own questions about Max. Had he sincerely been concerned about her safety when she had arrived back in Reno in mid-October? Or had he already been compromised by Harvey Whittemore? Wouldn't it make for an irresistible story to portray her as a gun-toting scientist with stolen notebooks? It would complete the image of a female scientist who had gone completely off the rails. She would eventually come to believe Max was sincere in his actions when she arrived back in Reno after the trip to Ireland, a week after her termination. But it seemed, in the XMRV investigation, a little paranoia was almost a necessity. The extent of Max's interactions with Harvey Whittemore during the following weeks is unclear, but Harvey eventually gained the young man's trust. Max became concerned that the stress was making him unstable, and he was concerned about having the gun. Max recalled, "I asked if I could meet with him. I had my gun in a bag. Harvey picked me up. I talked with him and asked him if he could take my gun for me and hold on to it or take it somewhere so I didn't have it at my disposal. He contacted the university police, I think his name was Todd, and spoke with him. Then we drove to the university police, and I gave my gun to them. They took it from me there and held on to it. Then I came back a few weeks later. I think it was Jamie, another university police officer, who returned it to me. After the gun incident, November 16, 2011, Harvey convinced Max to fill out an affidavit. Eventually, two affidavits would be created, although at the time, Max had no clue what an affidavit was. As Max recalled, "The first one, I think this is the time I gave the gun deal up, when I got grilled by the lawyer. They had me going to jail, this and that, and I was really blown away because I didn't feel I'd done anything wrong. So then I just explained everything that went on. My whole intention was I didn't want those things, the notebooks, disappearing, because I really didn't understand what was going on. But it seemed that it was very important to keep those notebooks intact so they didn't end up missing. There was a lot of time and effort put into them, a lot of work, and it would be a shame to have it all disappear." When asked whether Max considered the threat to the notebooks to be coming from the Whittemores or somebody else at the WPI, Max made it clear that he considered the Whittemores to be the threat. Max also was insistent that Harvey Whittemore had written both of Max's affidavits, an assertion that raises significant conflict of interest questions for a member of the legal profession like Harvey. Was Harvey acting as an attorney for Max? If so, an attorney is not supposed to act in a legal capacity in those situations in which he has a personal interest, just as a surgeon is not supposed to operate on a family member. Max's exact words recorded in a telephone interview on March 13, 2014 were, "Both affidavits were written up by Harvey." If Max's recollection is accurate, and Harvey did assist in the writing of Max's affidavits, it's difficult to imagine how one answers the claim that these actions by Harvey were not a conflict of interest. These affidavits would be a critical piece of evidence in the decision by the Nevada District Attorney to file a warrant to search the home of Mikovits. The role of Harvey Whittemore in the management of the WPI has also been a topic of some controversy. In an affidavit filed on November 7, 2011, Harvey described his role. "I am an attorney and an unpaid advisor to the Whittemore-Peterson Institute for Neuroimmune Disease, WPI, or The Institute, a nonprofit research institute located on the campus of the University of Nevada in Reno, with a research team, clinical laboratory, and patient medical clinic devoted to serving people with neuroimmune disease, NID. I work closely with the researchers and other employees at WPI. I am also married to Annette Whittemore, the founder of WPI." This view of Harvey's role at the WPI was further described by Dr. Frank Rossetti in a declaration he executed on May 17, 2012. Rossetti wrote, "I have had many conversations with Mr. Whittemore and have exchanged emails with him in which he spoke on behalf of WPI in a managerial or executive capacity. For example, Mr. Whittemore wrote and edited scientific correspondence on behalf of WPI. Exhibit 1 is a May 20, 2011 email exchange between me and Mr. Whittemore about his suggestion for the cytokine paper response. I also discussed Mr. Whittemore's examination of WPI's scientific data with him before WPI submitted the data to various recipients. Mr. Whittemore was also present with me at WPI's scientific meetings. I have participated in conference calls with Annette and Harvey Whittemore, in which Mr. Whittemore spoke on behalf of WPI about this lawsuit. Mrs. Whittemore never once said that her husband was not authorized to make the statements he made. Max explained his view of the situation and what he thought Harvey was trying to accomplish with his affidavit. I didn't understand what they were doing was a PR move, plastering them on the internet, trying to make it look like Judy was up to no good. And they were doing that to save face with the patients. I thought it was like I go to court and say what happened. That's what I thought the deal was with the affidavits. Like, I'm attesting this is the information I was giving. I tried to go over it with them, and I'm like, you're making it sound like I'm stealing stuff. And that was not my intention, to go in there stealing. That's my research. I paid for my notebooks. They didn't pay for the notebooks of mine. In summation, Max said, so I went in there, and every time he, Harvey, wordsmithed it to make it look like I was stealing. And as a result, that's hurt my career, labeling me as a thief, and that's not cool. So now my understanding is that the affidavits are no good. I'm not exactly made of money, and very quickly I was fighting a legal battle that has nothing to do with whether you're right or wrong, but how much money or power you have. So there was no way I could handle that. Max later spent time talking to one of the attorneys for Mikovits, Dennis Jones. He was happy to answer questions, but didn't feel comfortable signing an affidavit because of what he had already experienced. When asked about how he felt about the chain of events and what he might have done different, Max said, I would still continue with what I did, but I would have made a copy of them. I didn't want to fork over the money to copy all of those notebooks, go to Kinko's, because that was like 20 notebooks of 100 pages. I was a little bit cheap there and didn't want to do that. I figured I'd leave Judy to do that. On November 4th, 2011, the WPI filed a complaint against Mikovits saying she had taken documents, computers, and flash drives that did not belong to her. Mikovits officially replied through a lawyer that she had done no such thing. But the legal onslaught continued when, on November 9, 2011, a temporary restraining order and a civil lawsuit were left on her front step, eschewing the normal procedure for how one is legally served. On November 13, 2011, she returned home after a weekend away on a boat with friends and found it there. This prompted a flurry of texts between Max and Mikovits about what this might mean to the WPI's participation in the Lipkin study. Mikovits thought the lawsuit was making Lipkin skittish about the study, but felt she could work things out. On November 15, 2011, Mikovits texted Max that he should feel free to call her attorney if he had any concerns. Max did not reply. She texted him again on November 17, 2011, but there was no reply. It was only later that Mikovits would learn that on November 16, 2011, Max had approached Harvey and asked if he could hold his gun for him. Mikovits would come to believe this was when Harvey first learned the notebooks had not been secured by his associates, prompting the mad dash which would lead a few days later to the search of her house and false arrest. On November 18, 2011, a combined posse of University of Nevada Reno campus security and Ventura County sheriffs descended on her house, arrested her for supposedly being a fugitive of justice, booked her and put her in jail, all without a warrant. This and later events would seem to bear on her fears that somebody, or some group of people, never wanted her or the public to see the contents of those crucial notebooks again. Mikovits did not see the original version of the WPI lawsuit until March 2014, and it was then when she saw it contained only the affidavits of Harvey Whittemore, Annette Whittemore, and Vincent Lombardi. Surprisingly, there was no affidavit from Max Post, the one affidavit that was supposed to contain evidence that Mikovits had actually taken the notebooks. However, Harvey Whittemore's affidavit was of special interest, as it clearly showed his close association with the WPI, as well as seemingly corroborated the suspicions Mikovits had that the entire thing had been a setup to frame her and thus keep her quiet regarding the wrongdoing of others. In his affidavit, Whittemore makes clear that he knew exactly in which drawers Mikovits kept the key notebooks, the specific notebooks that would have revealed any errors and indiscretions made by anyone in her program regarding the XMRV study and controversy. So if one wanted to cover up those errors or indiscretions, they would first have to acquire those specific notebooks. Whittemore said in his affidavit, "The last time I was alone with Dr. Mikovits in her office prior to her September 29, 2011 termination, she showed me the locked drawer on the left-hand side of her desk where she kept the Mikovits notebooks and the notebooks of other researchers. On that day, Dr. Mikovits told me that the laboratory notebooks of researchers Post, Puccinelli, and Hagen were in her possession and in a locked desk drawer. I observed Mikovits unlocking her desk and pulling out a notebook prepared and used by Ms. Hagen, the Hagen notebook. Dr. Mikovits specifically referred me to particular dated references to laboratory activities in the Hagen notebook. It was the Hagen notebook in which Mikovits had seen potential problems related to the work of Katie Hagen, conducted at the direction of Dr. Lombardi, without Mikovits's approval or knowledge. Additionally, it was interesting to note that the WPI lawsuit said Mikovits had signed and then breached a contract which stated she would turn into WPI all copies of all data generated from her. In fact, the lawsuit said this supposed contract included anything she had ever written down, regardless of whether it was during working hours or not, on site or not. However, this contract, in fact, never existed, and when Mikovits later saw it, she recognized that the signature page was from another document, now attached to this fabricated contract. Around 7:30 that night, Mikovits was lying on her bunk. She kept thinking about the question Tom Adams had asked, and now another theory crept in. Could the notebooks be packed inside those two boxes of sheets and towels, so inconspicuous that they had gone unnoticed? She knew she'd have some free time later that evening and could call David. But she'd have to speak in code since the phone lines were monitored. The bail hearing was set for the next day, and there was a good chance that a rational argument might finally prevail. She would ask David, "Honey, would you check the linen closet and the Carol Roman, her friend from New York, bag? Because I really need some clean clothes tomorrow when I get out of jail." Would that be enough to make him open up those two boxes? She was mulling over a strategy when a call came into the cell. "Mikovits, you have a pastoral visit." When she looked perplexed, he asked, "Didn't you ask for a service?" Among the slew of questions at her booking, the only religious question she recalled was whether she'd like a Bible during her time at the facility. She said yes, but they never provided a Bible. Mikovits didn't really know what to say, but without a beat replied, "Yes, that's me." She wasn't going to miss a chance to leave her cell. That seemed to placate the guard, who then asked generously if she thought there was anybody else who might like to attend the service. Mikovits named as many people in the cell block as she could remember, and the staff retrieved them. Eventually, they gathered a sizable number, about 30 women. The guards led the group to a small room where a Catholic priest in a dark robe and white collar and what seemed to be a few lay ministers were setting up for a Catholic mass. The priest, a husky older man with fine white hair, strolled over. Physically, the priest reminded her of Derek Endlander, the doctor and researcher at Mount Sinai Hospital in New York she'd been planning to see before she'd been arrested. "You're Judy Mikovits, aren't you?" he asked. Mikovits couldn't get over how much the priest resembled Endlander. At this very moment, she should have been sitting with Endlander in New York, but yet here she was with what seemed to be his costume double, dressed in a black robe and white collar. She was so dumbfounded, she took a minute to answer. The other members of the priest's group, mostly women of about her age, hovered around and took great interest in whether or not she was Mikovits. "Yes, I'm Judy Mikovits," she finally said, feeling conspicuous. "Then we're in the right place," he replied with a twinkle in his eye. The other group members gave her warm smiles, then went back to setting up. The inmates were told to find a seat. One of the lay ministers motioned for Mikovits to take a place at the front of the room, which she reluctantly did. She still felt confused as to why they were singling her out. The opening passage was a tale of jealousy, betrayal, and justice from the Book of Daniel, the account of Daniel being thrown into a lion's den. Mikovits remembered the historical context of how a Jewish man had found himself at the court of the Persian emperor. Jerusalem had been sacked years earlier by another Persian king, and a number of Israelites were taken prisoner in what was referred to as the Babylonian captivity. Daniel was hand-picked to receive special training as a court servant, which attracted the favorable notice of King Darius. From Daniel, chapter 6, 1 through 3, "Then this Daniel was preferred above the presidents and princes, because an excellent spirit was in him, and the king thought to set him over the whole realm." What were the chances of the two men she was supposed to be spending this Monday night with, one a researcher in New York, and the other a priest visiting a jail in Southern California, looking so alike? The question of this serendipity kept intruding her thoughts. Had God reached into her prison cell to let her know she was not forgotten? The priest recounted how favoritism shown by the Persian king towards Daniel didn't sit well with the other princes and members of the court. Knowing Daniel was an observant Jew who, according to the dictates of his faith, prayed three times every day in the direction of Jerusalem, they concocted a hateful plan. They maneuvered Darius into signing a decree, which forbid citizens from asking any requests of God or any man other than the king for a period of 30 days. Failure to follow this decree would result in a defiant person being thrown into a den of lions. Daniel continued to pray three times every day in the direction of Jerusalem. He was seized by his enemies, who brought him before the king. Darius was distraught over the arrest of his loyal appointee, but it was his own decree, and he had to follow it. Mikovits could not help but reflect that even after thousands of years, when powerful people wanted to do evil deeds, they still followed the same playbook: twist the law to make a virtuous person into a criminal. In the morning, King Darius arrived at the lion's den to ask if Daniel's God had protected him. Daniel loudly declared, "My God hath sent his angel, and hath shut the lions' mouths, that they have not hurt me. For as much as before him innocence was found in me, and also before thee, O king, have I done no hurt." Daniel was removed, found uninjured because of his righteousness, and the tables then turned. And the king commanded, And they brought those men which had accused Daniel, and they cast them into the den of lions. The harsh Old Testament justice of the story made Mikovits chuckle to herself. Even if unjustly imprisoned, she certainly did not want her friends turned foes devoured by lions. The priest gave his homily, stressing the need for people to act with conscience, even if they may be attacked. They must hold tight to faith that if they do the right thing, God will protect them. Those words felt personally directed, resonating deeply with Mikovits. At communion time, most of the 30 women got up to receive the sacrament. Mikovits had grown up in the Catholic Church and thus knew one is not supposed to take communion until given confession or unless one's soul is free from sin. She had switched from Catholicism to a Protestant denomination prior to marrying David, so it had been more than a decade since her last confession. The pastor for the facility noticed she was not taking the sacrament and walked over. "You're not Catholic?" she queried. "No, not lately. I'm a devout Christian, but I'm a Presbyterian." The pastor was confused. "We got an email from Ireland that said it was imperative we have a Catholic Mass for you because you're a devout Catholic and this was very important to you." The Irish ME/CFS patients must have set this up. Mikovits was touched by their efforts to comfort her in this darkest hour. "Well, that's okay," she smiled. "I still appreciate it very much." Mikovits thought of the hurley stick and its inscription, "Chuck Yarlaw, our day will come."